Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Lee Dong-kil's daughter was born on December 31st, 2018. She arrived late in the night, 2 hours before the start of the new year. But 2 hours later, the baby girl became 2 years old. She was not alone in aging quickly. Every baby born in South Korea last year turned 2 on January 1st, 2019. Based on an unusual system for calculating ages, South Korea's babies become 1 on the day of their birth. They become an additional year older on January 1st. Lee Dong-kil remembers sharing news about his daughter's birth on social media. His friends immediately sent him messages to congratulate him. An hour later, when the new year began, they phoned me again to say congratulations for my baby becoming 2 years old, said Lee. I thought, ah, right, she's now 2 years old, though it's only been 2 hours since she was born. What the heck? By the way, Lee is 32 years old internationally, but 34 in South Korea. Exactly how this aging system developed is not clear. Defining a full-term pregnancy as one lasting 40 weeks is one way to explain why babies are 1 when they are born. But becoming a year older on January 1st? That is even harder to explain. Chung Yeon-ha is with the National Folk Museum of Korea in Seoul. He suggests that perhaps ancient Koreans cared about the year in which they were born in the Chinese 60-year cycle. Without modern methods of measuring time, they did not care much about the specific day they were born. Officially, South Korea has used Western-style calculations since the early 1960s. But many South Koreans still use the old system in their daily lives. The government has done little to get people to change over to the Western system. In January, lawmaker Hwang Ju-hong proposed a bill that would require the government to put international ages in official documents. The bill also urges citizens to go with their international ages in everyday life. It is the first legislative attempt to end Korean age. The goal of the bill is to end confusion caused by the mixed use of age-counting systems, Hwang said in the proposed legislation. His office said a parliamentary committee discussion and a public hearing on the issue are expected in coming months. Opinion studies in recent years showed more South Koreans supported international age. It was not clear, however, how seriously they wanted a change. If we use international age, things could get more complicated because it's a society that cares so much about which year you were born, said Lim Kyung Jae, head of the Seoul-based Miko Travel Agency. We should also definitely count the time of a baby being conceived and growing in its mother's womb. Lim's employee, Choi Min-kyung, who is 26 internationally and 28 in South Korea, disagreed. It's good to be 2 years younger, especially when you meet men on blind dates, Che said with a laugh. There is a big difference between 26 and 28. I'm John Russell.
Nicholson likes to play tennis after a day at school. She is only 10 years old, but she has been playing the sport for 5 years, and she loves it.
Something that I like most about tennis is the game. Just really gets my attention in anything that I do. Just brings up the fire in me.
Andrea lives in Washington, D.C. She is one of around 900 children who use the free services of the Washington Tennis and Education Foundation. The foundation was set up in 1955. It gives children from 8 to 18 years old a chance to play tennis and learn school-related and other skills. By combining sports and education, the group helps young people keep physically active and continue working on their studies. The Washington Tennis and Education Foundation has two programs. In one, tennis coaches go to schools around the city and teach the game to students there. In the other program, children go to the group's tennis center to learn the game on indoor courts. Teachers also help them with homework from school, design robots, and play games like chess. Audra Bell works with the foundation. She says the lives of children change when they decide to join the program.
They learn discipline and they learn mental toughness and all of the things that tennis teaches you as a whole. It's really amazing to see.
The group's president, Rebecca Crouch Pelham, agrees.
You're on the court, you're playing singles, you're by yourself, you're relying on yourself.
She says that is the same strength and ability to react to change that the children need in the classroom. Children in the program are successful in school. Crouch Pelham says all children should have this kind of contact with sports and educational services. It gives them a sense of belonging to a community, she says. Children who have completed the program come back to help in the summer as coaches. Mike Ragland is one such graduate. He says joining the program at age 13 changed his life.
I was doing things I shouldn't have been doing. Got myself in a lot of trouble. When I started playing tennis, it gave me a different path to life.
Because of his skill on the court, Ragland went to college and received enough financial assistance to pay for all the college costs. He then launched a career as a tennis coach. Coaches, in many cases, are like a parent for young players. They teach young players more than how to play tennis. Ragland explains that they teach the children good behavior.
We take the kids in, we talk to the kids about life, how to carry themselves, how to behave, and give them a structure. Something that they can go forward with.
Coach Ragland visited 18-year-old Xavier Boone's school 8 years ago to get young children interested in playing the sport. Boone says the program helped him learn much about tennis and life.
It teaches you not to give up, and it teaches you just to kind of push through life. Everyone here is doing very well in school, and that's just all thanks to the tutors and the teachers that we have here.
The foundation's coaches say a few of their kids go on to become tennis pros. Others excel in other fields and receive full financial aid for college, while the rest, officials say, get a solid basis to help them succeed in whatever they do in life. I'm Jill Robbins.
The world's biggest airplane has made its first successful test flight in the United States. The huge six-engine aircraft called Stratolaunch took its first ever flight last weekend over the Mojave Desert in California. The company said the flight lasted 2.5 hours. Officials reported the plane reached a top speed of 304 kilometers per hour and reached a height of more than 5,100 meters. Stratolaunch has the largest wingspan of any aircraft in the world. It measures 117 meters from one end to the other. Gene Floyd, the CEO of Stratolaunch Systems, said in a statement, "The aircraft made a fantastic first flight and landed with no problems." Test pilot Evan Thomas also reported a successful test during a briefing with reporters. "The flight itself was smooth, which is exactly what you want the first flight to be. And for the most part, the airplane flew as predicted, which is again exactly what we want." Stratolaunch was designed as a new way to launch satellites into low Earth orbit. It was built to take off with a total weight of nearly 600,000 kilograms. To support its size and weight, Stratolaunch has 28 wheels. It is powered by six engines made for Boeing 747 aircraft. Stratolaunch Systems was launched by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen in 2011 with the goal of building aircraft to send rockets into space. The company entered a partnership with Scaled Composites to develop and build the new aircraft. Allen died in October 2018. His death came just weeks before the company announced the plane's first successful ground speed test. CEO Gene Floyd spoke about Allen during the briefing with reporters. "It was an emotional moment for me to personally watch this majestic bird take flight and to see Paul Allen's dream come to life in front of my very eyes." He added, "I had imagined this moment for years, but I'd never imagined the experience without Paul standing next to me." Floyd said that as Stratolaunch lifted off, he did whisper a thank you to Paul for permitting him to be part of the project. The satellite-carrying launch vehicles are to be connected to the bottom of the plane. Once Stratolaunch reaches a height of about 10,000 meters, the rockets would be released and then air-launched to space. Stratolaunch Systems said the plane's airport-style launch system and ability to launch rockets over and over again will greatly reduce costs for satellite companies. The plane will also cut wait times between launches and is able to avoid bad weather areas, the company said. The business model aims to profit from predicted higher demand for satellite launches in the coming years. Stratolaunch plans to compete with other companies offering similar services. These include U.S.-based SpaceX and United Launch Alliance, a partnership between Boeing and Lockheed Martin. While Stratolaunch calls its aircraft the world's largest, other planes are longer from front to back. These include the Soviet-designed Antonov An-225 cargo plane, which is 84 meters long, and the Boeing 747-8, which is more than 76.3 meters in length. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History, in VOA Special English. There was one main issue in America's presidential election of 1916. That issue was war. Europe was in the middle of what is now remembered as World War I. It was the bloodiest conflict the world has ever known. Most Americans wanted no part of the struggle in Europe. They supported their country's official position, neutrality. This desire was the main reason President Woodrow Wilson won re-election. People gave Wilson their votes because they hoped he would continue to keep America out of the war. Larry West and Morris Joyce tell more about the presidency of Woodrow Wilson.
Like most Americans, Woodrow Wilson did not want war. He feared that entering the conflict would cost the United States many lives. Wilson read the reports from European battlefields. The news was unbelievably terrible. By the end of 1916, several million men had been killed, wounded, or captured. At the Battle of Verdun, French forces stopped a German attack. The cost was high on both sides. More than 700,000 soldiers were killed, wounded, or captured. The Battle of the Somme followed. Britain lost 60,000 men on the first day. By the time the battle was over, losses for both sides totaled more than a million. Germany also was at war on its eastern border with Russia. Losses on that battlefront, too, totaled more than a million men.
At the time of America's presidential election in 1916, Germany seemed to be winning the war. Its losses were terrible. But the losses of its enemies, the Allies, were even worse. German forces occupied much of northern France and almost all of Belgium. German and Austrian soldiers also held parts of Russia, Italy, Romania, and Serbia. Germany was winning on the battlefield. The Allies were winning at sea. A British blockade cut off almost all German trade with the rest of the world. Even food shipments were blocked. As a result, Germany faced mass starvation. It urgently needed to break the blockade and get food.
This situation finally forced Germany to make the decision that would bring the United States into the war. It decided to use its submarines to break the British blockade. The submarines would attack any ships that came near Britain or other parts of Europe. This included ships from neutral countries, like the United States. Earlier, Germany had made a promise to the United States. Its submarines would not attack civilian ships unless warning was given and the lives of those on the ships were saved. Now Germany was withdrawing that promise. It said unrestricted submarine warfare would begin immediately. German ruler Kaiser Wilhelm said, "If Wilson wants war, let him make it, and let him then have it."
President Wilson immediately broke diplomatic relations with Germany. He still hoped the two nations would not go to war. He left that decision to Germany. If German submarines sank American ships, Wilson would have no choice but to declare war. Most American shipping companies feared attack by German submarines. Throughout the early part of 1917, they kept their ships in home ports. They wanted protection. So, they asked for permission to arm their ships. At first, President Wilson refused to seek such permission from Congress. He did not want to do anything that might cause Germany to declare war. Then, he received secret news from Britain. British agents had gotten a copy of a telegram from Germany's foreign minister to Germany's ambassador in Mexico. The telegram said Germany was planning hostile acts against the United States. Wilson acted quickly. He began putting guns and sailors on American trade ships.
It did not take long for the worst to happen. Within days, a German submarine sank an unarmed American ship, the Algonquin. Then three more American ships were sunk. Many lives were lost. President Wilson no longer had a choice between war and peace. There would be war. Wilson called a special session of Congress. Members of both the Senate and House of Representatives gathered in one room. They stood as the president walked quickly to the front. He stood silent for a moment before speaking. This is what he said.
"Fully understanding the serious step I am taking, I advise that the Congress declare the recent acts of the German government to be, in fact, nothing less than war against the United States. It is a fearful thing to lead this great, peaceful people into war. but right is more precious than peace. And we will fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the rights and liberties of small nations, and for the belief that a worldwide union of free people can bring peace and safety to all nations.
President Wilson's emotional speech brought tears to the eyes of many of the lawmakers. They felt the great seriousness of his request. Outside, crowds lined the street to cheer Wilson as he returned to the White House from the Capitol building. He sat in his car and shook his head sadly. "Think of what it is they are cheering," he said. "My message today was a message of death for our young men. How strange it seems they would cheer that." On April 6th, 1917, Congress approved a declaration of war against Germany.
The Allies, Britain, France, and Russia welcomed American involvement. The war was going badly for them. It had been very costly in lives, money, and supplies. Allied shipping was suffering heavy losses from German submarine attacks. A British naval blockade had greatly reduced food shipments to Germany. Now, Britain itself faced dangerously low supplies of food. Allied representatives went to Washington to explain what the Allies needed. They needed supplies, especially food, immediately. They needed money to pay for the supplies. They needed ships to get the supplies from America to Europe. And they needed American soldiers.
President Wilson and Congress worked together to organize the United States for war. Congress gave Wilson new wartime powers. He soon formed a council to build ships, improve industrial production, and control national transportation. He formed an agricultural agency to increase food production and food exports. And he formed an information committee to build public support for the war. Wilson's efforts succeeded. The Allies quickly got the ships, supplies, and money they requested. Most important, they soon got American soldiers.
Allied military leaders said only about 500,000 troops were needed from the United States. But American officials decided to build a much larger army. Before long, large numbers of American soldiers were crossing the Atlantic Ocean. They would fight the Germans at the western battlefronts of Europe. The extra strength they gave the Allies would play a major part in helping defeat Germany.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.